The EF and Rad Snowboard Podcast is presented by Vans. All right, guys, a couple of quick announcements. Burton created a special day to honor the memory and legacy of Jake and invites you to take part in a day for Jake on March 13th. The invitation directly from Burton says it best. With Jake's passing this past November, the snowboarding community lost its greatest champion. We've been overwhelmed with the continuous messages of support from all over the globe, so Burton has decided to do something all together on a huge global level on Friday, March 13th, 2020. We aim to honor the memory and legacy of Jake Burton Carpenter by coming together to do what he loved the most, which is snowboard. 13 resorts globally are joining a day for Jake, offering free lift tickets to snowboarders on March 13th. Marking the first time resorts have opened their slopes for free to snowboarders. All riders are invited to ride for free in the following resorts that stand out as emblematic of Jake's vision of an ideal snowboarding experience: Boyne Mountain, Michigan, USA, Summit at Snoqualmie in Washington, Big Sky Resort in Montana, Avoriaz in France, Absolute Park in Austria, Copper Mountain and Woodward in Colorado, Boreal Woodward, Tahoe, Lox in Switzerland, Cypress Mountain here in Vancouver, Stratton Mountain in Vermont, Bear Mountain in California, Madonna di Campiglio in Italy, Seki Onsen Resort in Japan. Okay, we would like to reach out and personally invite you, your colleagues, friends, and family to join us all on this day for Jake. Snowboarders around the world are invited to celebrate a day for Jake by simply getting out and riding anywhere on March 13th and sharing their experience on social media. Make sure you use the hashtag RideOnJake. Get out there. Have fun. I'm excited to be a part of it. I'm going to be up Cypress Mountain recording interviews with people about Jake's life, and I'm going to put out a tribute episode. I've been talking about that. So if listeners of the show want to get involved in that, reach out to me on social media as well. Also, the world-famous Baked Salmon Bank Slalom returns to Mount Seymour for its fifth season this Saturday, March 14th, powered by local riders on the Locals Mountain. This season's Bank Slalom promises to stay true to the fun times and healthy competition for all. With each passing year, the competition gets stronger, and there are rumors of some very expensive wax jobs, so nothing less than your best is required if you want to grab a trophy and the right to call yourself a Baked Salmon winner. Proceeds from this year's event go to support the Russ Lee Recovery Fund. And now to the show, guys.
Oh yeah, I wanted to be absolutely not attractive to snowboarders.
Maybe we need an injection of that, because it'd be interesting.
And I didn't sign the contract, all I just had it in my bag for a couple months.
And we're all like, oh, that's just banging, let her run.
We pushed each other to become better.
Front three tailed it.
Season 5 of the F and Rad Snowboard Podcast is sponsored by Wired Snowboards, the Boardroom Snowboard Shop, Crow's Nest Barbershops, Anon Optics, and Tribute Board Shop in Nelson, B.C. Support for the show also comes from Mount Seymour, Cypress Mountain, and Grouse Mountain, Vancouver's local places to ride. And special thanks to Swix Wax and Volcom Outerwear. Wow, that's a lot of love. Thanks to everybody who supports the show. Tribute Board Shop is run by some of my favorite people on the planet. Tribute is more than just a snowboard and skateboard shop. They're a community. The first thing legendary skate park builder Jim Barnum texted me after I sent him a link to listen to this week's show was, "Tribute Shop, woo!" And at the Bank Slalom, Jamie Lynn agreed that the hoodie and shirt graphic he designed with the Tribute logo turned out rad. That's right, Tribute Shop hoodie and t-shirts have a custom Jamie Lynn graphic. A lot of you have reached out asking how to support the show, and honestly, the easiest way is by showing the sponsors that you've heard about them on the podcast. So somebody out there order a Jamie Lynn graphic shirt or hoodie at tributeboardshop.ca. The further from Nelson you are, the better. When they tell me it happened, I'll reach out to you and I'll talk about it in the next tribute ad. I just thought of that right now, so let's make it work. Tribute Board Shop, the real fucking deal. This week's guest is a returning guest and one of the original snowboarding pros. Tom Burt's commitment to exploring mountains on a snowboard has inspired generations of pro snowboarders, and Tom couldn't be a nicer guy. So this interview was a great way to end an amazing trip I had this year to Lake Tahoe.
Do you have a fitness regimen that you follow at this stage?
Never had one. The only fitness regimen is just doing things.
Yeah.
So I just stay active.
Yeah.
So.
But you know, do you do stretching or anything like that?
A little bit of stretching. I've always been a tight wound person, so stretching has always been not exactly what I do on a daily basis. I do more of a maintenance for my lower back.
Yeah.
Which has always been a problem. So it just runs in my family.
Oh, that sucks. Back issues are, as I'm getting older, I'm realizing are the one that if you can dodge that one, you're pretty lucky. And when we were younger, it was like knee issues, you know, because there were certain people that would just get knee replacements and all that. I don't think I could have dealt with something like that. Now I'm staying away from the back issues if I can.
Yeah, well, I've been laid out, you know, many times. Can't move.
Farmer was talking about they were some of the first people to document Alaska on film in that TB one, like totally bored. But
yeah.
he acknowledged that you and Jim had been up there before them.
For sure. We were there in 89 and they were there in 90.
Yeah.
And we filmed that with the North Face. And but you know, we didn't get much footage in general just because we had like the snowiest May on record. We were there for 28 days and saw the sunshine for 3.5.
Oh man, that's an epic trip. Obviously.
Obviously, all we did was shovel out our tents.
How long have you been with the North Face?
Well, I was with the North Face back then, until the early 90s, and then they had issues with internal issues with figuring out what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so the picture of me being with them, they kept screwing around with stuff, and I just never went back on as you know, full team, but I've always worn their gear and done stuff with them.
Yeah, because I remember when we were on Ice Age, you'd on the big trips especially.
Yeah.
Riding North Face gear, because, and we talked about this before, like the Ice Age stuff was maybe 8,000 waterproof, or it wasn't technical, and it was sewn, single sewn, stitched in Hawaii.
Well, the thing is, you know, my world was, I had to, you know, when you go in the mountains, you have to be serious.
So, right.
And that just came with the game. I just wasn't sponsored by them, but I used their gear because it was good gear.
Yeah, yeah. Did you, how long did you stay with Ice Age? 3 or 4 years? The whole stretch of the thing?
Yeah, from when basically, you know, I came on until they decided to
close up shop. Your board on that was so sick. I got a shot on their brochure that 1 year on riding your, it must have been a 62.
Yeah.
That was such a nice board. Just a easy to ride shape and.
Yeah, it's, you know, that was a bummer because that was a fun. I really enjoyed Mike and Mike. Yeah, and Mike, which was a good family. I mean, you know, I hear from everyone once in a while.
Yeah,
still, but
yeah, I've reached out like, you know, a Facebook message here or there with Paz or Madeliner, and I have a yearly conversation with Patello. I try and stay in touch with that guy.
He goes. Canada these days.
Oh, yeah, so. Totally. Well, he's got his place in Revy, that's right. Yeah. And like everybody up there, you know, city planners and the mayor or whatever, they know him.
He's such a character.
I love that guy. Did you do some trips to Hawaii in those days? Like, would they fly you down there and you could surf?
I did a couple trips.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's where I got my nickname, Tommy Over the Falls, from those guys.
It's such a honor and treat to sit down with you, man. Like, you've been crushing it since before crushing it was a thing. You know, that early Avalanche team plus your push with Jim to, you know, explore the world of mountains, just led the way for the way that snowboarding went, you know, the hand in hand relationship with the athletes and the magazines and even resorts and operations, that we owe a lot to you, man. Thanks for that.
Yeah, for me, it just, you know, it kind of happened. You know, snowboarding wasn't a planned thing in my world by any means, but just pulling, you know, doing the things that I'd loved to do turned into pushing the sport in directions that, you know, and opening up the ideas of, you know, going to resorts and introducing snowboarding to them, to going to mountains. You know, it was always, it's a dream. Jim Zellers and I basically just sat down and made a list of places we wanted to go to, mountains we wanted to see, and started working on going and doing that. And, you know, that included, you know, Alaska, Europe, South America, Japan, you know, New Zealand, and on and on. So we just kind of made up that list. And the only place that I didn't go to, for the most part, was Antarctica, just because it was so expensive.
Yeah.
And it just didn't happen timing-wise. There wasn't really a well-set-up way of getting there and things. And so it, you know, it was beyond the cost that we could incur.
Is there good mountains down there? Like, is there stuff to...
Oh, yeah, it's insane.
Stuff to get into?
Yeah.
Have you been there?
No, I haven't. I've been there, but no. But now there's a group that's been doing boat trips down there for quite a few years.
Oh, man.
Which, you know, so there's yearly trips now that happen, and that's, but you know, so it's opened up and definitely.
Is it on your bucket list? Are you still pushing to go?
I don't push anything. If it happens, it happens. You know, yeah. it's all good. Same old thing. I mean, I didn't even basically leave Tahoe. Last year was the first year I didn't travel in 35 years.
Wow.
You know, it just happened that way. And but it was a great year here in Tahoe. So
yeah, February here last year was pretty all time, huh?
February, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, and July. They were all really good.
Jeremy Jones said that when he would push out into the Sierras, he was hard pressed to find somewhere that you and Jim hadn't already been.
Yeah, like, well, we tried to do things, you know. But there's plenty of, you know, there's so many different places, you know, nooks and crannies and places to go. It's,
yeah,
it's insane.
I've had a crazy, wonderful week riding with Dave Hatchett, and got a chance to ride with Kevin Jones and Corey Octoon and and Devin up at Squaw, which was sick.
Yeah.
And I could see how this zone would be somewhere that, especially if you had like a family and stuff, there's no really any reason to go anywhere else. There's just plenty of fall line here and different aspects, and it's all facing in different directions. So you just read the forecast, and if you got access to passes or even backcountry access with sleds or splits, like,
yeah, well, it's a pretty much, you know, you can, even on our worst years, you can always go find good snow if you know where to look. I mean, that's the nice thing about it. So Tahoe, on the whole, has a wide variety, but we, you know, we generally are lucky with snow conditions, which kind of adds into it. I mean, we do have our cycles where we have some high heavy danger, but it's usually relatively predictable if you look.
Right.
And then also, but our only issue is that when we do have generally bad conditions, we usually have big slides, not little ones. So right. People get in trouble a lot of times just because of the sheer mass of snow that moves here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was the first time that you snowboarded? Would that be the early 80s or would it?
82 was, wow, the first year that I snowboarded, 82, 83 season.
Yeah.
So.
And then when would the first time be that you like went on an overnight mission where you camped? That'd be like 4 or 5 years later, or?
Yeah, it was, well, I would guess that our first, I'm trying to think. I mean, we overnighted ski, you know, I skied, grew up skiing. So
yeah,
we overnighted ski, like backcountry skiing, back in the early 80s, like 83 or something.
Oh, man.
But so now I was, you know, 19 or something like that. But, you know, I backcountry skied in high school. You know, we used to go do Talac. You know, it's a peak here at Lake Tahoe and South Lake. We used to go ski that.
Where did that idea come from? Were there pioneers ahead of you that had done it?
'Cause... Well, our, like, I guess what was he? Our science teacher or whatever? He'd go, he was going skiing over there. So we were like, okay, let's go do it. But at the same time, my older brother used to backcountry ski all the time. We hiked, even as a little kid. I didn't have any money to buy a ski pass, so we hiked, as you know, that's how we functioned, as functionally skied when we were young.
Rad.
We, you know, whenever we had ski skate week, which was $2 to ski, and so those are the days that I skied really as a younger kid.
Yeah.
Until I bought my own pass, like, you know, at 14.
Oh, damn.
To when I could start skiing, because my parents didn't have the funds to, you know, pay for us to ski.
Right.
So I worked and paid my own way.
At 14,
that's what I wanted to do.
what was your job, like paper boy or work at the
no Save I worked at the something? Theater.
Yeah.
So I started working at the theater when I was 12.
Damn.
Cleaning the theater, and then started working 13. I actually worked. I did two jobs actually. I worked at washing dishes in the summer, and then that winter at 13, I actually worked at Powder Bowl, which was a little ski area, just to get a ski pass.
Rad.
But then I didn't get the ski because I was working.
Yeah, so, that's the trade-off there.
So that didn't work out so well, and I realized that was the wrong way to go. And so then I bought my pass the next year. And I also started working at the beach. You know, just I worked seasonally on the beach.
Rad.
My friend started a parasail business and started doing that on the beach. And
oh, that's pretty
when
cool.
When I was 14.
So. That's awesome. I remember when we talked before, you mentioned the, I think it was a McDonald's commercial. I can't remember. Maybe it was the...
The first commercial.
Wrigley's commercial?
Yeah. Wrigley's juice fruit commercial.
I still watch it sometimes.
Yeah, like, it's pretty classic.
Because it's... I think Craig's in that one too, right?
Yeah. Craig and Jim and... Terry Kidwell and
nice.
Lori Gibbs.
Lori Gibbs, yeah.
And Bert Lamar.
But Lamar was in it too. What an eclectic group of people from all over the place. How did that happen?
Well, that was just, you know, it was just happened at the World Championships out in Breckenridge.
Okay, yeah, because
Basically, the spring of '87.
Yeah,
and Greg Stump just invited a few writers and said, "Well, you know, let's film this thing. These guys are interested in maybe doing a commercial. We're going to do it on spec."
Yeah,
and they shot it, and then they decided to make the commercial.
That makes a lot of sense, because if Greg Stump wouldn't have been involved, it would have been a completely different thing, right? Like, people who don't know how to shoot.
Yeah, so the only shot that wasn't shot by Greg Stump was just the hand planting of Terry.
Yeah,
that was, I don't know who shot that.
That's pretty sick. That commercial is legit. Like, when you watch it, it's for 1987.
They put us in SOS, you know, ski wear Sweden, like ski clothes, and whatever. It was all fine by us. We were just going for it.
And you guys got residuals. Is that how that one worked? Like,
yeah. So you don't get paid. We didn't get paid to make the commercial.
Right.
So like you normally would, if you got hired. You know, you'd get shoot like a day rate. So we didn't get a day rate. We just shot it on spec. But then when you get residuals, then they pay you that day rate in the first residuals.
Oh,
so
cool.
The first residuals are bumped up compared to if you got a day rate, then they don't have that bump. So you still get paid your day rate, but it just gets paid, later on if the commercial gets made.
Yeah, that's,
you just don't get any money if you know,
up front, like, or up front. if it doesn't get picked up, you just did that day for free or whatever. But
that time we weren't making any money at all.
Through
snowboarding, so that was the first.
It looked like a fun day too, right?
Oh, yeah,
like,
it was great. Yeah, it was, I mean,
sunny pow day.
It basically, you know, paid for the down payment of my house.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's the best. So, and that would have pushed you away from being a teacher, right? Like at that point, because you had become a supply teacher at that point. Or,
no, I was a high school math teacher.
You had a full on high school math job.
And well, I had student taught, and then I took the class over.
Yeah.
And then
wow. And
then I was trying to snowboard, but that wasn't working because I was teaching.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I went to the world championships. You know, competed, and then that commercial was shot, and then I was debating what to do, and I was like, well, I'll try to be a snowboarder, and then that came through, which
it worked,
which kind of set, you know, gave me some freedom for a year to not have to stress. And I mean I was still working three other jobs just to pay to snowboard as that happened for years and years and years, but that's it, you know, there was no money basically in snowboarding you know, for anybody. You
for those first 5 years or something, 87 to 90.
Well, 85, you know, yeah. I got sponsored as, you know, like Terry Kidwell had already been sponsored, you know, since 83 or something, and same with Bob Klein and everything, but still they weren't making any money.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't know if Terry's really ever made any money because he was just so early.
He's just that you know? One generation early.
And,
yeah.
And that's just, you know, the reality of, I don't think of any athletes starting in a sport that just starts up, there's not really anything there.
Yeah. Yeah. The pioneers are kind of doing it for gear or whatever.
Well, they're just doing it because they love it.
Right.
And then, and then it just turns into something, you know, that's the whole thing is that, you know, none of us were like really trying to be a professional snowboarding on, you know, we were just snowboarding and the ability to snowboard more and have that, you know, well, you're going to be sponsored. You're going to give me a snowboard. Sweet. I don't have to go out and, you know, spend, you know, $250 or whatever they were at that time.
Yeah.
Was just, you know, that was just amazing to, you know, if you, you know, to be able to have that happen.
So. And then you figured out the travel budget thing. I mean, I guess a few people probably figured it out at the same time because Craig was, it was all exposure based, right? Like every second of a base shot or every second.
Well, yeah, just it was, Burton. I mean, you know, exposure became a way or the way of kind of getting paid, but we worked on knowing how to do it, you know? So we were the first people to really say, okay, well, we're going to set up trips. So it goes back to the bucket list that I was talking about.
Yeah.
So we had our bucket list and it's like, well, let's start clicking on our bucket list and how are we going to do that? And how are we going to get people to send us there? So that we don't have to pay to do it. That, you know, and so we talked to the magazines and at that time, you know, you have to think this is before video, was out there. So the only exposure you had for the most part in the early days was racing. So if you raced and you did well, you get exposure. Then the magazine started, and then the magazines needed content. So they needed to write about something. So we were like, well, why don't you write about us going to wherever, you know? Yeah, so we started that whole relationship with the magazines, you know, starting with an international snowboard magazine and doing, you know, trips around the States. Was some of the first ones that we started because it was easy to go to, you know, Colorado to a trip or go to, you know, Wyoming or into the Sierras or.
I love the idea of you guys writing letters to these places.
Yeah, well, we did everything we could, you know. But then when, you know, when Snowboarder and Transworld started, which was pretty much the exact same time.
Yep.
You know, all of a sudden we had three magazines, and we knew that they all needed content, so we got. You know, we basically just looked up their photographer list, you know, their contributing photographers for snow and skate stuff, whatever. And we just sent letters to everybody.
So cool.
This is who we are. We're the Avalanche team. You know, we're in wherever we want to shoot with you, you know, and all these photographers, you know, they were getting the note from the magazines, they needed snowboard shots. So that's kind of, you know, so we kind of pimped our way into that world and, you know, introduced ourselves. And then kind of the first year that Snowboarder and Transworld came out, you know, or we were everywhere, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Even though we didn't have any boards to sell, we didn't have any marketing. The company was bankrupt already, you know, trying to grow.
I think the biggest Avalanche ad that I can think of is like OP. OP was Ocean Pacific was printing, you know, base graphics of Avalanche everywhere. I can't even remember if there was ads.
Well, you know, so OP became like the first clothing company for us, like, you know, the Avalanche team. We asked clothing companies, you know, at the ski show and everything, and all the ski companies would just laugh at us. Like, why would we want to sponsor you? You know, snowboarding, it's a freaking joke. No, it's going to be, you know, you want to be in on it early. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, but no one would really step up and do anything. So we... OP was the first company to like step up and put some marketing into it. And actually, you know, they paid us a little bit of money, and that was, you know, incredible to us. And, you know,
right.
We had to wear really shitty clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't make anything technical. It was like windbreakers and shit.
Yeah, it was terrible. And, and it was in the height of neon too. So it was double bad.
Yeah. I don't know. It sort of caught everybody's attention.
Yeah,
I mean,
but it's,
from an internal, like, right. From a, like, when you get your box of OP and you open it up and you're like, oh my fucking God.
Yeah.
You know, Damien would wear the most black stuff that they had, which was just like black sleeves on a big green neon jacket or whatever.
Yeah. Like for me, that only lasted basically a year because OP realized that sponsoring this whole team wasn't going to be the best thing for them, that whereas sponsoring Damien, taking all the money they were giving to Jim and myself, and Bonnie, the little bit that they could pay Damien and keep him, you know, sponsor him with more money and not have us. And then it was great timing for us, like Jim and myself and Bonnie, because that's when we moved to the North Face.
Right.
Because we were already stepping into doing more backcountry stuff.
You couldn't go further from the technical product, right? Like like windbreakers to like mountain gear.
So we, you know, because we started really doing, you know, overnight trips like you were asking about earlier, you know, like where we were, you know, spend the night out and do it, you know. And in tents or, you know, Vivian or whatever, didn't matter. And so that was just, you know, it turned out to be good timing.
Where did the big turn thing start for you? Like, where?
What do you mean?
Like your turn. I remember I asked you, was this you in this video where I showed you some clip and you're like, no, look at how many turns that guy made. I would only made one turn. Like, was that skiing or?
It comes from the style of riding that, you know, it's like skiing. I call, you know, snowboard skiing most of the time anyways. But I grew up in the era right after the freestyle skiing happened. So that was, you know, the generation before me was moguls, aerials, ballet, that whole thing in the ski world. And when I grew up skiing, we wanted nothing to do with that.
Right.
Because we were the next generation and big mountain skiing was what we did. You know, we all skied at that time, you know, GS, Super G, or downhill skis, mm-hmm. like the whole group. So, you know, nothing under 200 centimeters. And then, you know, 210s, 215s, 223s. You know, there was there were signs at the ski area, you know, you couldn't ski down Scott Chute, example, at Alpine Meadows. You know, they had like, no skis shorter than 185. You weren't allowed to ski this run on short skis. I mean, it was just a funny thing.
So, that's awesome.
So, we, you know, I never skied moguls. I still can't today.
Like, sure, me neither. I hate them.
No, I like moguls on my snowboard. I can't ski. I can't do it on skis.
Oh, wow. I can't do it on snowboard. I can't do it on anything. I stay
but
away.
On a pair of skis, I still can't make that turn, like that transition in my brain.
Yeah.
We GS'd the moguls, just went across the top of them and made big turns. So, you know, going down the mountain was the style of skiing. So that's pretty much what I knew of how you should go down a mountain. So I kind of emulated that in my snowboarding.
Yeah, you crushed it. The best at it.
When we started, Jim Zeller and I were like, well, we wanted to be able to do everything we ever did on our skis on our snowboard, you know, and I'd done a lot of, big drops and cliffs and all kinds of different stuff on my skis, because that was what we did. And so we started trying it on a snowboard, and then after a few years, then we started realizing the snowboard was a different tool, and then we could do different things. So that started to allow us to do narrower lines and be in control in narrow lines and controller speed in places where you couldn't do it on a pair of skis at the time, because the skis didn't have the flotation.
Right, right.
And to get the flotation, you had to have the length. And so now, you know, now that's changed, of course, because the ski industry copied the snowboard.
Totally.
Concept of a flotation side cut, or, you know, all those different things, all different shapes, rocker and whole gamut.
It kind of went back and forth between snowboarding influenced skiing. Then those skiing big rocker skis came out, and then snowboards came out.
Rocker snowboards have been around.
Oh, that's true.
Since, you know, way before. It just got skiing, you know, snowboarding needed to get control and be part of the industry. And so we moved towards the ski industry.
Yeah.
And which was fine, you know. But they influence each other, and it's fine.
Yeah.
But at that moment, you know, we were doing things on our snowboard that maybe like a couple guys on skis could possibly pull off.
Yeah. Glenn Blake and Scott Schmidt. That's about it.
No, cause those guys were different, you know. Only those guys were skiing not in a style like a snowboarder was using the mountain they were skiing. There was only a couple guys kind of rolling around, in that realm of like using their skis differently. And now, you know, now it's like the ability to, you know, have the float and be able to use your board in different ways, or skis in a different way, you know, has changed the whole dynamics. So it's allowed skiers basically to do the things that we were doing on our snowboard.
Totally, so. Totally. I think I've talked about it with a few different people that snowboarding just seems to have baked into the core of it something a little more creative or a little more open-minded or like a different way of looking at the mountain than skiing, just in that, like, because it doesn't take much to stand up on a snowboard and almost right away you start looking at, you know, this side hit over here or like this like a wave, let's hit this like a wave, which you don't really see intermediate level or beginner level skiers kind of venturing into that kind of more exciting terrain. They're sort of just like working on their technique and turning down different runs or whatever, whereas snowboarders are using those intermediate runs with the side hits and everything. I see that. That's kind of my, you know, guess on it.
Well, skiing traditionally, you know, was just to go down the hill. And,
yeah.
And so that's what, you know, I mean, that's kind of why it never really changed or progressed, because that was what the ski industry felt the push was to go down the hill. And, you know, snowboarding changed that concept of going across the hill, and using features that are there, using terrain, and that changed, you know, the dynamics. But like I say, now the skis are there, and a lot more skiers are doing that.
Yeah.
In general, you know, they're skiing in a fashion that using more of the terrain.
Yeah.
And so it's really fun to watch and see, you know, much more cross court, and, you know, action going on.
Are you kind of like Palmer in the, you never really had a beef with skiing ever?
No, I never had a beef with skiing. I mean, any good skier, mm-hmm. what I would consider a good skier.
Yeah.
Basically, didn't have a beef with anyone who was a good snowboarder at all. You know what I mean? It just was a reality. It was full of respect. You know, there's always idiots. Doesn't matter what's going on.
Right.
You know? But, if you know, the only issues I ever had were guys who I would consider not to be good skiers, you know, and they'd be the ones mouthing off or trying to be, you know, idiots. And it was a pretty easy shutdown for me, at least, because I just invite them to take one runner of their choice and then take one run of my choice.
Yeah.
And then tell me what they think of snowboarding after that. Right. And I never had one person take me up on that. So I'm pretty sure I could have taken them places they didn't really want to go and at speeds they didn't want to necessarily ski at, because I know, you know, I mean, there's skiers who could easily go with me, you know.
Yeah. But
the guys who were mouthing off, I knew that they, you know, but they pretty much shut their mouth up pretty quick.
Do you feel like you had a bit of an advantage in those early days of snowboarding because of the design of those avalanche boards? Like the kick and the bumps had a really like nice rocker to length to width, kind of, you know, and a bit of a flex through the whole thing, where, you know, a lot of the competition was kind of ski construction, really thick through the middle. And
yeah, it just was, you know, I mean, there was always, you know, the boards, like the ironing boards that people call them, you know, before the kick series.
Yeah.
You know, we over designed those towards the ski industry because the ski industry was just so anti like snowboarding, and we were like, well, let's give them something that they're used to.
Yeah.
And they worked. You know, we could ride them and you can carve turns on them and you know, more race oriented, mm-hmm. you know, although we ended up doing a lot of freestyle on them, but they, you know, it was more designed after a ski.
Did you go hard boot, soft boot at that time?
We always, you know, I mean, our hard boots weren't hard like what people think of.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, mine, I modified mine so that the upper cuffs, you know, Damon would just blow out his one side of his upper cuff, so he'd get full lateral motion front back. I actually made a slot and made mine, you know, slide so it wouldn't just completely collapse.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, so we modified our boots all the time, modified the tongues, modified everything to, you know, our boots were, hard boots were basically as flexy as a pair of soft boots with straps on them for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't, what people think
like
of
ski boots.
They weren't ski boots at all. So it, you know, it, but they did have, you know, we definitely had a lot more power having a solid sole. You know, so you get a lot of power for your turns, and we needed it for those boards.
Yeah.
You know, so, which was fine, you know, it worked for us. And, it was a tough sell, of course, because, you know, people want something that's, on the most part, it's like the same thing. You know, you still see, you know, everyone pretty much riding soft boots. And
well, I bought based on seeing you guys doing what you were doing, I bought a Kick 175, and then I got those. I mean, they must have had like 9 or 10 pieces per binding, because there was like a toe and a heel piece, and you had to put them in separately. And then the same, whatever Damien was riding, those Emery bindings or something.
Yeah.
And that was the only way that I learned to turn, because in soft boots with felt linings, your feet were in so much pain. You were just kind of fish turning around everywhere, and you couldn't really get the board up on edge. But then I was literally in ski boots, which were like uncomfortable and stiff, but you could hold an edge. Like you could just carve down the hill. No problem on those things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was still, everything was still progressing in just such a, you know, infancy of the sport.
Yeah.
That there was no, you know, like proven track or any way to go. Everyone was just trying. I mean, there was people trying to do lawsuits about releasable bindings. And everything, like all the way across, you know. And I mean, I was one of the few people who I made my own releasable bindings, and they worked. You know, I didn't have any problems with them, but you know, people wanted me to go to court about releasable bindings and shit. And, you know,
there was that one dude. Who was that one guy?
I don't know the names, but he had an
invested interest in switching to releasable bindings. Yeah. And I remember going to when I met you actually at that Montana Transworld Industry Conference. They did a thing on releasable bindings, and this guy was just like propaganda across the board, like, we got to get rid of the leashes, people's straps are breaking, people are getting killed by these boards flying down the hill. Like, I was like, I don't think that these releasable bindings are going to help that.
No. It was just going to
break somebody's legs or something.
He kept hounding me because he knew that I was the only person ever to ride a release
to make
set.
One work. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But I never let him see him. I never let him, anything. So,
well, Farmer said he built a pair from scratch as well, because it was Breckenridge said you could ride a snowboard as long as you had a releasable binding, which didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
So he just built it. And he's like out there in somebody's garage somewhere. I wish I would have.
But you got to remember, probably in, you know, in Link's garage or something.
Oh, probably.
In Colorado, that'd be my guess.
Yeah, yeah. But he said that his didn't work very well. Like, he would just every once in a while just pop out of them.
I mean, I just turned mine in. I mean, they worked, but I pretty much made them not. I could make them non-releasable at the same moment.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. Like a lockout or something. That's pretty cool.
So, but they, you know, they, I ended up breaking them at Baker. I forget what it was, like, I don't know if it was 86 or 87, you know, just free riding. And I broke one of my, you know, bindings, and I just switched. And then I never did anything with them again.
how was Baker in the mid 80s? Was it just as
fun as always?
Yeah. Like the same as it is now.
No one was there. No, it's not the same as it is now. There was no one there.
Yeah.
You know, you'd ride under the, you know, we just basically, you know, you'd ride up chair 5 or like 6 or whatever.
Yeah, the double, like
it used
the,
to
two
be the
chairs.
Two chairs.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And then, but they, you know, and then just do power runs. And then when they, then you do power runs till you're so tired, and then go take your run.
Yeah.
At least that's what Zellers and I would do, I should say.
Were you guys climbing that Hemispheres hike those early days and getting over into the Elf Chutes and?
Well, people were hiking, but you didn't even have, at that time, there was, like I said, there was no one there, so.
Oh, yeah, there was no ropes or anything,
too.
It
was just untracked.
Yeah.
And didn't really matter, so we were just riding power off the lift because it was, you know, snowing. I mean, we had good conditions, then it was, you know, it just happened to be hammered snow, so we didn't hike that, you know, it didn't matter. You do the course and take a left turn at the end of the course and just go hit the power run back to the chair.
Amazing. Know, so. Yeah, that's a nice little zone in there too, actually. Yeah.
And like I say, there was 20 of us or whatever, 25, 30 of us, you know, racing or whatever, and that was all that was on the mountain.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty mellow.
So. Oh, shit. You know what? I just realized I heard that you won the Dirksen Derby.
Yeah.
Congrats,
I did the Derby.
Man.
Well, I ran in the old guys over 50 category. So I don't really win, you know.
No, you won.
I won enough, but I beat out the rest of the old guys. I beat Chris Jameson, which is the first time in my life that I've actually beat him in a race course.
Right.
So that's a good thing, because he just turned 50. I'm 55, so I beat Chris because he was always a racer, and I. So, you know, he just kicked my ass. So this is the first time I've been there.
How's the proliferation of these more community-based fun events? I mean, Baker's always been Baker, but now there's several more. Is that something that is drawing you out just to go and beat Chris Jameson? And
I do some comps with my friend Devin Rainey, who's blind, so I guide for him.
Right.
And so he likes to do the Derby, so I went up there to do the Derby with him, and then I do it also. And then also he wrote a book called Still Sideways about him going, he went blind at basically 33.
Wow.
So he wrote a book about his life, which doesn't necessarily about him going blind, but just about his life in general. So it took him 5 years to write it, and Patagonia just published it. So
sick.
Yeah. So it's cool. It's a great story.
That's really inspiring.
So he was doing a talk up there, and then he asked me to come up and be part of his talk. So I was there for that also. But yeah, but the comps, like the fun comps are fun. You know, I try to go to things that are enjoyable.
Yeah.
So whether it's like the JLA at Mammoth, put on by Billy, for go do that one. And Dirksen's same type of thing. You know, it's like, it's a great cause for, you know, raising money for, Tyler and the crew and everything like that. So they do, you know, do a really good job, and they're really fun, and the community's fun. You know, it's like at the Derby, there's 500 snowboarders. You know, it's like Baker, there's, you know, 500 snowboarders. It's always fun to get together with 500 snowboarders.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you were mentioning, you know, the first Baker, there was what, 25 or something.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just mellow.
Yeah,
and it just is. You know, I mean, snowboarding's grown a little bit. So,
snowboarding is unique in the fact that it was such a fiery sport, and it's, you know, like when it was 20 years old, it had already run the gamut of like becoming the most highly watched, you know, Olympic sport or whatever. I mean, 78 to 98.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
there were some people obviously doing it before that, but I mean, nothing else has had a trajectory where it just went like from like a total obscurity to like the most watched thing on the planet.
Crazy. I mean, it's... I mean, however, you know, it went, it definitely had a growth curve within the snow industry, but the snow industry is very small, you know, still relatively small.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, not saying that people didn't watch it, like you said, but that's the hardest thing to, you know, put a realization on, is that how, you know, relatively small really the snow industry still is.
Yeah.
You know, if we, you know, as a snowboard athlete, you know, if I was an athlete in any other sport, I could have some money. not have to have some other job, you know. Like, yeah. I mean, it's just the reality. And, it, you know, it's not good or bad. It just is what it is. It's just an interesting thing, though. You know, there's basically really very little money and, you know, for people in the, you know, for athletes and in the industry, it's very 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 small.
Yeah, the accessibility of it, like, you know, you could sell a $20 skateboard to absolutely everyone on the whole planet, because no matter where you live, even if there's a smooth patch of dirt somewhere, you can intuitively know, like, just roll back and forth. You could sit on it, you could put a board on it and paddle, like, whatever you want to do. But to get a snowboard, you have to have a snowy hill. Like, to.
Well, you're limited. Yeah. I mean, there's limitations in that, in the, as far as accessibility in mountains, but also limitation for the general costs, which are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, it keeps the numbers low. Even the ski, you know, like the same thing, the ski industry too is a small industry, comparatively speaking. You know, when you go meet people anywhere out of a mountain community, you know, they really have very, very little interest in the racing, in the, you know, what's going on. They might go to the mountains once in a while, but it's not like they're living that, you know. There's now, you know, countries in Europe where the communities are in the mountains, part of the mountains, they're, you know, it's part of their culture. And, mm-hmm. and you know, so, and then it, you know, it is like a national sport. And, you know, you go to Austria and it's a national sport, skiing, because so many of the cities are right there at the base mountains and towns and everything. It's just surrounded by it. So it's a different, completely different reality.
Yeah.
But over here, you know, I mean, there's, I don't know what the percentage of people that live next to the mountains is. Pretty small compared to the, you know, yeah. the amount of people that
yeah.
live in America.
Well, a lot of pros in the 90s, mid 90s to mid 2000s, up until about 2001, actually, for like that 5 or 6 years there, where the industry had exploded so much and everybody jumped on it and was like, wow, there's all this money to be made. Like, some of the athletes were getting crazy checks. Like,
yeah, well, that was, yeah, it was kind of a, you know, I mean, for me, it was funny because I didn't really get paid that well, but it wasn't what I was trying to do.
Yeah,
I wasn't like out pursuing money. I was out pursuing going snowboarding, which was fine. Like I said, I don't have any like regrets or like bitterness or anything. I'm stoked that people got paid. I'm stoked that we had growth. You know, that whole thing, but it was very interesting to see, in my world, because, I have tons of respect for lots of riders, but at that time we had so many riders who were getting paid that were good riders, but they weren't like someone that I was looking up to and going, I want to be like that person.
Right.
And that was like, and for me, I'm like, well, then why would you be paying that guy if I'm not going to look up to them, but the companies were just like anyone, you know, like we need to have athletes, you know?
Right.
So there was a lot of people who made decent money, you know, and got that, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of contracts through and had a stint in the snowboard industry. And they, you know, but then they just disappeared. There's very few that had any staying power.
Yeah.
The ones that had staying power are ones that, you want to watch.
You look up to. So, yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so it was just kind of a funny thing. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be in the industry and, you know, I've been a sponsored athlete since 1985.
Wow.
And, you know, I've been through pretty much, you know, generations now of different athletes that have come through.
Yeah.
And know a lot of them and ridden with them in different aspects, you know, so whether it was, you know, from Terry Kidwell, who was, you know, in my high school class.
That's so amazing.
You know, and Alan Brewster and Bob Klein, we all skated together. We snowboarded together.
Rad.
You know, so our little group here in Tahoe, to, you know, starting to meet everyone in the early days from back east, from Colorado, from Utah, from the Northwest, from Canada. And then, you know, as time went on, moving through the next generations that came in, you know, the early the late 80s, early 90s generations, where you had, to me, the next push.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was in freestyle, well, you know, we had Palmer, of course, here also, you know, like, but we, you know, we you got that next push of Andy Hetzel, and you got the next push of, you know, I mean, it goes on, you know, on to, you know, like, all kinds of different riders that came in different genres. You know, whether you get James Lynn or you get, you know, but you know, when Craig, you know, Craig was in that early, and Dano, and, you know, like, yeah, different. I mean, there's, yeah, so many people. I mean, my list, it gets way too big, but my point being that, like, I've been lucky enough to be still with the new generation of riders into like the Free Ride World Tour and,
yeah,
and all of that. And, you know, riding with all the young, mountain riders and, you know, watching, you know, basically being in Alaska and guiding, you know, Travis Rice for like kind of first heli stuff, you know, like way back,
yeah,
you know, and having him, you know, like that group. And, you know, I mean, it's just like all these different groups that I've gotten to ride with all the way through. So it's really fun. And now I'm working with, the junior tours locally here, which is fun.
That's super rad that has materialized in the United States. The next cool push of like competitions, I think.
Yeah, well, it's just fun. It's still good. It's good to see the young kids and get to know them and be out there with them.
Well, you picked the right path for longevity. I think that's the thing. Like, had you pushed really hard in Olympic, I mean, in half pipe, like, there's a limitation to what you can learn and then the equipment that you've learned on, like, whereas you're still relevant in free riding because that's one of those things that where wisdom is actually a huge asset, you know? In some of the freestyle events, wisdom would probably keep you from doing them. Like, you'd be like, this is a dumb idea. I'm going to break my fucking neck. But
yeah, you know, I mean, that's, I chose things I like to do. I still like to ride pipe and stuff.
Yeah.
It's still fun. I still, you know, I always liked it.
You ride a super pipe? Like, you would you, can yeah, you, yeah. can you get air out of a super pipe? Because I can barely get to the lip.
No, I can get out of a super pipe. but it just is one of those things that, it just wasn't what I considered to be the most fun. I was lucky enough to be able to turn what I liked, which was, big mountain riding, into, something that I could present as a marketing idea, so that just, you know, it set me on that path. I mean, like I was talking about earlier too, about the magazines, you know, we had to race because there was no way to be seen. And then we started with the magazines, which allowed us to go on these trips and do the things that we wanted to do. And then videos started, basically. And then it was like, well, now we have another outlet, marketing outlet, which was to get shot, you know? So then we started doing both. So we would do a story and the video, you know? So we just kept the add on and then, you know, of course this is before social media, you know, so you didn't have that outlet, you know, everything didn't have to be so instantaneous. And, you know, so it's kind of one of those things, like how to be relevant within as a marketing tool, because that's basically what your job is as a professional snowboarder. You're the marketing tool.
Yeah.
And you know, we did the best we could do with what was going on at the time, you know, and over time that marketing tool changes because of how the media is used. So,
well, one of the things that would have been, I think, you know, great for your career is that you weren't posing for those still photos. Like, when they were taking a picture of you, there'd be like a, you know, part of your shot would be the line that you did. So that was left to our imagination to be like, holy shit, he just did that. As opposed to like some of the freestyle stuff, they could be on a trampoline or they could just be grabbing their board and falling into a big pile of snow or whatever the hell they're doing. And then when video comes out, you're already poised to be in these videos because the things you're actually doing. There's not like a lot of posing going on.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, I mean, it turned into that. And then of course, you know, I had to work on lots of things because, you know, the first time you see yourself on video, you're like, you just cringe because you're like, oh my God, am I standing up straight? And I should really bend my knees. I look horrible, you know? So,
I can't imagine that because as far back as I can go with Tom Burt footage in my head, you're just like a smooth operator.
Yeah, but you know, that's the, you know, I mean, I got to see myself on video pretty early on, you know, just, just in general, just because like Avalanche, you know, we shot our own little mini videos. So, you know, like video started really, you know, there was videos, but they were just put out like team videos.
Mm-hmm.
So there was the Sims video, there was the Burton video, you know, like,
yeah.
So they, you know, there weren't independent videos, you know, and then, you know, Fall Line Films kind of started and Standard Films, you know, at that time,
yeah,
you know, they both kind of started putting out independent stuff, you know. I mean, there was independent stuff in skiing, you know, you had your Warren Miller and you had your Stump and you had, mm-hmm. you know, but not in the snowboard world.
Right.
And then once those independent guys started, then it changed, you know, the team videos kind of died.
Yeah, yeah, because you know, the team videos, the incentive for the video was to film the guys on the team.
Yeah.
Whereas these independent videos, their incentive was progression of the sport.
Yeah, basically, you know, and then, of course, you know, then money starts to talk, so then you yeah. get companies to buy their riders in. But I was lucky enough to have, like, Mike Hatchett, you know, as an example, just believe in my abilities, you know, so he, you know, even though like my sponsors base pretty much never sponsored his movies, he always put me in there because he believes in me, you know, which was a really cool thing, you know, to have happen.
I remember it really legitimized Ice Age when they were on that box cover that first year. Like they wanted to go for it and they wanted really badly to be a legitimate,
yeah,
cool snowboard company. I think they did a really good job. But also it was in that era of like the payoff's going to be huge later.
Right.
And then they go, oh my God, the payoff is not paying for the athletes we sponsored.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it just was, you know, that was in that.
It's a niche heyday. Market. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But that's just a, you know, reality of that growth time.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Cause that year when Ice Age came out, so did, you know, 250 other yeah. companies.
Yeah.
Like it went, Vegas went from, the Vegas SIA show went from, you know, 30 or 50 to 250, yeah. 300, and then, and even beyond. Like you could just think of any word and there was a board company that was that word.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was, I mean, for good or bad, you know, that's just,
it was fun. That's what it was fun. Did they, because I remember that Montana trip, you and I were on a bus from the airport and then we were sitting in some symposium probably about those bindings, and I was sitting beside Botello because he was their sales rep,
right?
And so he knew me from the shop. We'd done a big order, so we were hanging out and riding with the mics, and he was fanning out. He's like, holy shit, that's Tom Burt. And I had just talked to you on the bus.
Right.
So I was like, oh, I know that guy. He's like, introduce me. And then the next thing I heard was months later, you were on the team, which, did they come to you with a good offer? And you were like, hell yeah.
Yeah, it was just kind of like I say, that was a transition time for me from the North Face kind of deciding that they want to promote big mountain riding.
Yeah.
And the marketing people there knew nothing about big mountain riding. And yeah. so they were like, well, we're going to basically not sponsor you. Like I had to reintroduce myself, like write them a letter.
Weird.
About, you know, about myself, like why I should be their big mountain rider. And I'm like, if you don't know why I should be your big mountain rider, I don't want to work with you, basically. You know, it was just like, right. it was just amazing.
Right.
And they kept doing, well, they did a bunch of stuff, but basically they didn't really know anything. There was a lot of turnover. There was new owners. There were new marketing people. Mm-hmm. There was new, you know, there is in big companies like that all the time. There's a complete disconnect between the marketing people, the designers, the owners, you know, like all within, and the athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when there's turnover and things happen like that, there's always just kind of like sideways action that goes on within a company.
And
not
then,
that not yeah. that it necessarily hurts the company overall in the long run or
it
in
could.
Short, but it yeah. does, you know, yeah. like it, and but there's just no, you know, they want their growth and everything, and usually the growth slows down, and you know, then they're like, well, what's the issue, you know? And then they usually come back to, you know, so like that's why like I always get, I still can get North Face clothing.
Rad.
But
at that time, the Ice Age thing.
But it was just a total mess.
Yeah. The Ice Age is the total opposite because those guys are huge fans of your shit.
Right.
Like they know who you are and they're willing to pay to have you on the team.
Yeah, it was just like, say, timing wise.
Yeah.
And And then it was also board wise, it was the same thing, like avalanche snowboards, was, you know,
transitioning
and doing, you know, or had gone, I, you know, and it was just kind of good timing to be with those guys.
Then did you go to Kemper from that? This is going to be a repeat of the last episode because I thought Kemper was before, but Kemper was after.
No, was Kemper? Yeah, I forget. I don't know. It's a blur.
Were you on the team, the Kemper team with Martin
Gallon? Yeah.
Yeah. So it probably was before.
Before, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you do some trips with the Kemper team that Hetzel?
Oh yeah,
Martin.
Yeah,
like chaos. That was just like insanity.
Yeah, we did some trips, but it was good. You know, it was fine. Like, I mean, I didn't have to do any tramp tours or anything like that. So
yeah.
Like those guys had to do. I said no. Sorry.
Oh, that's awesome. I think Kevin Jones was on there briefly, and he was talking about, you know, being a kid with the Kemper guys and the credit card and just they had a reputation, right?
So that was most of the money spent in Kemper was right before I was there. So which it was fine, you know. And yeah, because Kemper, yeah, it was definitely before Ice Age, because I rode Denali in 91 on a Kemper. So
oh sick.
Yeah,
yeah, that's unbelievable.
So
where, if you had to choose a trip to do today, is there somewhere that sticks in your mind that you're like, I want to go back to that? That was, interesting terrain or like epic fall line and great snow.
Well, there's plenty of places. Great snow and nice fall lines. It's a hard thing because, you know, if you're looking at mountaineering, I've taken a lot of mountaineering trips. But mountaineering is you know, like mountaineering snowboarding, to have good snow is a flip of the coin. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been lucky to have good snow in a lot of places. I mean, we're a lot of marginal or rough, you know, terrain of snow. Because that's just mountaineering. You know, when you're in the high end mountains, you know, you never know what you're going to get. So it's a tough one.
Did you deal with altitude sickness when you're in like Nepal or somewhere where you're so high up?
I've been lucky not to get altitude sickness on the whole. I mean, you get worked by altitude, you know. Like in Nepal, you know, like it's super brutal to your body.
Yeah,
and so you have to deal with it. But mm-hmm. I've been. Like my body's been pretty good about it.
Well, I guess you grew up at whatever this altitude is, right? This is 6,000 feet or something.
Yeah, just over 6,000.
So like, yeah, because I find coming here from, you know, sea level, walking upstairs is,
you feel altitude. Everyone feels it at different places depending on your body. And, but it just is, I just been lucky enough not to have it. You know, it can happen to anybody. I mean, you can go to 12,000 feet and get your ass kicked, and at the same time you can go to, you know, 24,000 and feel fine on the next day.
Sure.
It's just a relative thing. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
So but I've been lucky, like I said, not to have any like adverse effects. I mean, not that altitude doesn't kick your ass and you're super tired and all those things.
You know how to deal with it. I think I've had it the worst when I was like we did one Ice Age trip right from Vegas up to Brian's Head, Utah, which I don't know what the elevation is there, but it's definitely not sea level. But we were also drinking heavily and not sleeping very much.
Yeah, both those don't help.
Yeah, no. So I had it pretty bad, and had it pretty bad at Timberline too. But it was similar conditions: drinking a lot and not hydrating properly, and getting dried out in the sun, hiking the pipe all day.
Yeah, well, food and water.
The basics.
I mean, when you go to high altitude, then it's pretty much sugar and water. But
really.
Well, yeah, because your body stops processing, proteins and fats and things that. So the only thing it can kind of process is simple sugars.
That's incredible.
So you kind of survive on simple sugars and water. Otherwise, you're just losing weight.
Yeah. You were showing me your winter stick board last year at the bank slalom, and it had wood sidewalls. I thought that was pretty sick. How's winter stick going this year? You still on that project?
Yeah, still doing winter stick stuff. So you know the factory we make all our handmade boards, so they're expensive, but they're real nice. And then, we hand make our own cores. We do wood sidewalls, which are really fun. They actually give structure to the sidewall, so you actually get like a flex out of your sidewall.
Totally.
And different style of dampening than just like like a plastic does.
So sure.
It's just a different feel. It's a lot more responsive and. I really like the wood sidewalls for general riding.
As a part of the company, do you upgrade your board every year, or do you have a board that lasts a few seasons?
I kind of have two of the same boards. More or less. They have different top sheets. I like different woods, but this will be like. One of them is 2 years old, and one of them this is its second year.
Yeah.
So this will be its third year and second year.
That's incredible.
Like I don't, I get other boards and test them and ride them and things like that, but, I don't trash boards too. I mean, I ride them hard. These boards last a long time, which is a really nice thing.
That's right.
They don't break down. We build our own core, lay up our own cores, glue them up, laminate the whole thing. So it's a really fun project.
Yeah.
To have going on, So
that's fun. It's keeping you from having to do that 9-to-5 thing.
I don't. I still have to work, but it just keeps me with good snowboards, which is a really important thing for the winter.
Sounds very similar to the beginning. It's like
it's been the push the whole time.
Yeah.
Having a board that I like to ride is a really important thing for me.
And you've been able to have that all the way through, it seems like. Like you haven't had to
since camper, I've had a board that I've designed directly.
Yeah.
So that was in the early 90s there.
And has there been much change to that design, like taper?
Not much. I still ride pretty much the same board. I just like it. There's tweaks here and there, but I, for the most part, still ride very similar board. And I ride other boards and I like them for certain things. I was riding smaller boards for the Dirksen Derby. Say because it was so turny, which is fine and it's fun, but then when I'm out just free riding and I'm riding that small, like a small board, then it's just too like turny for what I like. It's fine for runs and everything, but just for daily riding of the style of like how I like to ride, I just missed the board that I like, and that's just reality. And so the board that still has my name on, it's still a lot of people, why would you ride a board like that? It's just like that's what I like.
Yeah.
And I ride a lot of other boards and test them out, and I do So.
Stand by the one that you like.
Yeah, I mean, I ride their Swallowtail a lot in POW. The Winter Stick Swallowtail. That's a super fun board to ride.
It's really nice to be able to just stand up on a board and not have to worry about leaning back. And
I
guess that's true, right?
If I have to lean back, I throw the board away. it's not how you snowboard.
Right.
Well, I mean, people do snowboard that. I don't snowboard
yeah,
that way.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just reality.
You literally don't throw boards away. Like I've talked to you about it before.
I just meant I just don't ride it.
You've got a great collection of boards, right? Like
I've got some snowboards, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a great collection, but it's some sort of.
There's some valuable boards in there, though. Like there's a Sims board I remember talking about with you. That's
yeah.
Like
there's some boards that people might pay money for.
You know,
probably the I have a camper board that's, you know, it's got bindings that Dave Camper made and stuff like
oh,
that.
Oh wow.
That, you know, handmade by him. That you know. I don't know. Probably the only one of its kind type thing. You know what I mean?
That's incredible. Was that when he was in Toronto or did he move somewhere when he started?
I don't know where he made that one, but it's, you know, it's early on. And like I say, the bindings are probably worth as much as the board. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah. But this is your personal collection. You're keeping them because
they're just on my ceiling. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
not,
yeah,
not
yeah.
like not like I'm. I mean, I don't know. You know, maybe they'll go to a museum someday or whatever. I don't
sure.
have. I have no idea. You
yeah,
know? I mean, my wife's getting tired of being on the ceiling, so they might have to leave.
Oh no! All right. Well, some listener out there right now is going to call you or send you an email. Like, I want those boards. We're doing a museum.
Yeah.
More and more collectors every year. Just to, you know. Of different, rare, weird.
Yeah.
I think I just heard Corey say, I can't quote the number, but it was a lot of money for the Jamie Lynn board that he rode in his TB2 part or something
right.
like that, which is a one of a kind, right? Like a, you know, octopus graphic on a Matt Cummins with the kink and all that. And we're talking thousands of dollars, though. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's all fun and good,
yeah,
you know? And like, you know, but I'm not holding on to him to as an investment,
right?
You know,
right,
like,
right, right.
You know, I mean, I have a board. I gotta find out. I forget whose board it is. It was a Canadian rider, and I forget his name now. I have it on my ceiling, and it was Transition. He handmade it himself and
Whoa.
Named it and everything. And it's a wooden board and he has made his own bindings and the whole thing. And I totally space on his name. I feel so bad.
Is it like a prominent pro from the, like an Evan Fien or a Neil DeFerne or somebody like that?
No, I forget. I forget his
Transition. Yeah. I've heard it mentioned the brand,
but it was just a early, handmade board and,
Brad.
He gave it to me for my ceiling, and then I totally spaced on. It's bad, but that's just. But I like I said, but I'd love to, you know, get it back to him at some point.
Oh, that's right.
You know, like
yeah,
you know. And the only board that I'm missing that I had any connection to was the first Avalanche board that was made.
With the triangle.
With the ironing board style.
Yep.
So I had given it to our local snowboard shop at that time, Rob Wells, Snowwave. And when he shut shop, someone took that board.
Oh, man.
And so, but if they ever see it, I know it.
Yeah.
Because it was one of two boards that had like a white base. Like pure white base on it, and but it just, you know, disappeared. I don't know if it exists anymore.
Yeah, it probably does somewhere. Chris would have made that in his garage, kind of thing.
No, this was the very first production board made by Palais, which was which was the ironing board one.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we made some kind of ironing board ones that were shorter 150s that were softer but this was the first one that was made with ski construction and beefed up. And, but it just, yeah, it's one of those things. I'm just like, it disappeared. And, but you know, I know it could be out there somewhere.
Yeah. Did you keep some of all your pro models, like the camper board and the Ice Age stuff?
I have most of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, but not, I don't know if I have what I don't have is like all the different size ranges. So, right. Because I usually rode, a 72 or so.
Yeah.
Thereabouts, but there was 66s and 62s and 57s or, like in different
sizes. Yeah, I rode the 62. It was just, pretty much what I'm riding right now. I'm riding a 61 that's very similar.
So, but that just is, I just didn't have like,
you didn't order
every size.
Yeah, you didn't order those. some people did. I think Rippy had every size, every color of every board that he'd ever had. But he sold that to a guy up in Canada, actually, a complete set.
Right.
Because I don't know, he wanted to maybe put a deck on his house or something.
Who knows?
They're taking up space, right? Like that's the thing. Is it at the end of the day, if you're going to move.
Yeah,
it's a lot to deal with.
Yeah. Well, it just is, I have more boards than are on my ceiling, type thing. But that's just the reality. But not that they all are. There's a lot of things I have that are boards. They seem like boards to me. Maybe someone finds some value in them, but I have no idea.
How's the so you're coaching now the local free ride team?
I'm running the junior contests for them.
Very cool.
And then I help coach the high school team.
What does high school snowboard team? What does it look like these days?
Well, here in the States, they only do racing. So they just do slalom and GS and stuff. But they're just not serious. A lot of the kids are just learning to snowboard, and you have a huge variety. But so it's really fun to help kids get better.
Yeah.
Out there. So that's fun. And then I, like I say, I work, I help, run technical direct the junior comp here, both skiing and snowboarding.
Is that still affiliated with the Free Ride World Tour? Is that still affiliated thing?
It would be kind of, yeah. So the junior tours, so the junior tours here, they qualify you for like the world junior tours.
Right.
And then they also, if you do well with that, you can also, when you turn 18, because the States doesn't allow you to compete, you have to compete as a junior until you're 18, and then you can compete in the qualifiers. But I think it sets you up to be qualified to be in the qualifiers. Allows you to, if you do well in the juniors, I think. I try not to be involved in that part of it. I more care about the kids and the competitions and how they're running, things like that. So it's a little different.
Yeah, you've had a hand in a lot of amazing contests, right? Like the Travis had you judge that first year of his.
Yeah, I judged all three.
I
judged all three of Travis's contests, and then he's actually, I think, considering future contests at some point. We'll see what happens. You never know.
Yeah.
So.
He did a Free Ride World Tour stop last year and it was.
Yeah. He's done a couple. Yeah.
That was really, you could see he stood out amongst the competitors as somebody who can read terrain and hit stuff and really, do some tricks confidently in some crazy zones.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Travis is, an incredible rider.
Yeah.
And, so it's super fun to have been involved with all his stuff.
That's rad. So yeah.
It's just, somehow, lucky enough to be involved with all, all that.
Well, there's a huge respect. That's what it comes down to, is that you've earned a huge respect in the snowboard industry from pretty much everybody. There's nobody that I've ever talked to that is not a Tom Burt fan.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
Just being honest.
I'm sure I was an asshole to somebody.
Oh, I doubt that very much, actually.
Most of that skier, like I said, who wouldn't take me up on my offer.
yeah, that's about it, right?
No,
I remember actually feeling a little bit dumb and bad, like because one of the, I think one of the mics, probably Madliner actually, was like, when we were at the Mount Hood house, said, Tom says he doesn't spin, but I'm pretty sure he did today. I saw him do an alley-oop in the pipe. And then for whatever reason, it fell on me to make the decision whether an alley-oop was a spin or not. And I was like, fuck, well, technically it's a 360, but no, it's not really. Like, you know, at the time. And,
right.
And I remember you were pretty disappointed that I... You're like, it's not a fucking spin. It's a 180.
Whatever, it doesn't matter. I mean, I can spin. I just don't.
Yeah, like it was like on principle. You're like, I just don't.
It's not. No, it just is. You know, yeah. I mean, I do it at times, but I'm sure. Just like, it's just not something. Don't necessarily like think that spinning around is super fun all the time. So, I just don't do it. You know,
it was right after that new school, old school skit that was fun. And I mean, I talked to Chuck Barfoot about 5 years ago, and I just went through and listened to it again. And he said that, all this freestyle stuff where you're jumping in the air, that's not real snowboarding. Being like, you know what? You can be a purist in any way you want, right?
Yeah, well, it's, you know.
That's fine. It's dope.
I mean, it's for me, it's all snowboarding because, you know, people ask, you know, what about, you know, like, you know, rails and this and that. And I'm like, you know, it's all good. Or, you know, like, the full, you know, in the city riding and all that, you know, you're like, it's all fine. You know, like from my perspective, in the sense that if it brings new people and, onto a snowboard that would have never snowboarded, you know, that's way better, from my perspective.
Yeah.
You know? And so many people, you know, if you look at like a Gucci as an example of someone who came into the sport, who, you know, started in that realm of, you know, kind of rails, this, that, you know, and then worked his way.
Yeah.
And now, you know, now he's guiding and you know, in the mountains and, you know, and has respect in that. And that side, you know, you're like, you know. You never know who you're going to introduce to the sport.
True.
That
yeah.
could be, you know, the next person in any direction. And so, you know, I have no beefs at all with any part of the sport that brings more people to it, because it's, you know, it's supposed to be fun. I mean, you know, the same old stupid thing is, you know, there's no rhyme or reason for snowboarding. It's, you know, it wasn't invented to do something.
Right.
Besides for just slide down the snow and have a good time.
Yeah.
And however you want to do that, you know, it's like, it's pretty simple, you know? So that's the whole, you know, like my view on that. I'm like, I'm stoked to have all the aspects of snowboarding add in, you know, it was this, you know, it's the same, you know, like, you know, we kind of had to be rebels to stand out because we had to fight the system. We were basically fighting, you know, more or less discrimination against us to be allowed to be on the mountain.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was, you know, so you're stoked to have assholes to nice people pushing that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
You know, so the bad boy, you know, like, oh, you know, all snowboarders are derelicts, you know, whatever, you know, that whole genre, it was fine, you know, because it still was pushing the growth of the sport and that it was independent and needed its own world and space. And, you know, and, you know, not that I had to be a derelict, it, you know, I didn't need to be, I had plenty of other friends who were, you know, this was great, you know, yeah. You know, and all, and full respect, like I say, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, most of the people who played that game were some of the smartest people that I know. You
yeah.
know, if you look at Farmer or Palmer or Hetzel or, you know, and then the list goes on, the current, you know, Sean, I mean, you know, Johnson and Kearns.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, you know, those guys are freaking awesome. They're great brains. They're great people. And yeah, they were screwing around and, you know, like screwing with the system and pushing buttons and, you know, but it was great. It was great, you know, to be around it and be part of it. And, know all those guys. It was almost like a political movement to get, you know, snowboarding. We, you know, there was an agenda to be like, to exist. Otherwise, totally. Otherwise, you know, let everyone just you know, stomp you out. I was like, no, we're going to exist. We're going to be here. Sorry. You
know? Yeah, totally.
So it was, you know, I mean, I was lucky enough to be part of all that. So.
Yeah. All right. You know what? You've been here an hour and a half, and we've run the gamut of, I could stay here and talk for another 4 hours because that's just who I am. But
I don't know that much more, but I know a couple more things.
Well, I definitely appreciate your time and appreciate you coming up here, and it was really good to see you again. And we'll see you at the bank slalom. I got in this year.
Oh, nice.
So I think I don't know what category I'm in. I'm 46. So
well, you're in the 46-year-old category. But it just depends. So, yeah. So you can run amateurs, or you can run.
I'm running pro men's masters. I think so.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. So that's
up to 50, right?
Yeah. That. Yeah.
And then you guys are battling it out. There's a lot of guys in your category now.
We're in the legends category.
Yeah, which is
over 50.
Big competition. Now, like a lot of really
well, the
great dudes.
It's always fun. I mean, the most fun is that, you know, you're racing against guys that you've been racing against for 30 years, which is funny as shit. But we have a great time. Although we're, you know, we're still relatively competitive. You know, I mean, even you know, we pushed the Masters. You know, which you're in now.
Yeah,
You know, but and then.
There was a battle between you and Alex Warburton. I don't know if you knew.
Oh yeah, no, but it's always.
He wanted to. Like, as long as I beat Tom,
my. it's always good because that's the most fun.
Yeah.
That we have
those rivalries
that we go out there and we've raced against each other and I've beaten them and they've beaten me.
Yeah, you know, yeah, totally.
Like, you know, and you know, like last year, you know, Matt Cummins won for the first time ever, which was just freaking insane.
That's awesome.
Right? It was awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And Alex took second and beat me, you know, and you know, and you know, it's just fun.
It's a race.
Know? And
yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it just is a blast to see those guys, ride with those guys, you know, giggle, laugh at the top, the bottom of the course.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, we're still there because we love the snowboard. And so, you know, the people who show up, you know, it's always awesome and super fun. You know, it's the same, you know, it's like I've been lucky enough to win the bank slalom once. Well, yeah. I won it twice in the same year, but so it's really only once.
How's that even possible?
Well, they had a retro race for the 20th anniversary. So I
right.
won. But really, Rob Morrow won the retro race.
How is this?
Because they gave us a handicap for gear.
Oh,
so
okay.
he rode a switchblade, which was and had high backs, and I had no high backs. So I got a half or quarter second advantage. So
unreal.
You know, and he beat me by two tenths of
that.
So
I
got the trophy.
I
gave him the jacket because he deserved it because he beat me.
That's amazing.
I called him up, you know. But
yeah,
you know, it was just like a funny thing, you know. So but it's super fun.
You know?
Like but the whole thing is fun. Like say putting 500 snowboarders together is a blast.
It's awesome.
And so, you know, that's You see the life and the stoke of why we do this stupid fun sport. You know, I mean, I still go out there on a daily basis and snowboard. So, and it's
you got some good days over this weekend. Was there good snow at Bachelor?
It was pretty good. Yeah, I got a little bit of new snow. You know, I mean, they didn't have much base to start with, but riding was good. You know, and it was a little rough because they didn't have a base. They couldn't groom as much and stuff. So it was rougher for like, say, when I was there guiding with my friend Devin.
Right.
So when as a blind guy riding down beat up, like when the snow gets beat up, it gets kind of brutal. But we still had a blast. And I had a blast.
Does Jerry Lopez come out for that? Cause it's in his backyard.
He does sometimes. Right. He's not in town. He wasn't in town right now, so
probably good surf somewhere.
He's down where it's warm. Alex's son was there. He was racing.
Cool. Cool.
That's how I know Jerry wasn't around.
Yeah.
But it wasn't at the race either. But I was talking to Alex and he, you know. So.
What a great community of people snowboarding is, hey? It's just fucking awesome.
Yeah. I'm lucky because, I've got to know. So it's probably now it's like, you know, four generations, I guess, of snowboarders.
Yeah.
And, you know, working on the next generation with the young kids, you know.
Yeah, man.
They're not in their 20s yet, so I don't, you know, but, you know, the kid, you know, people I know are in the 50, you know, 50s,
yep,
more or less my age, you know,
yep,
in the 50s and then the 40s and the 30s and the 20s and now the teens.
So. It's crazy when you move up a level. Like, I'm...
So.
Petrified of the 50s, but all through my 40s I've just been in pain. It's crazy, like the things that I used to do in my 30s are insane now.
Yeah, but, well, it's, you know,
that's why we got to stretch, I think. I don't know, now I'm kind of a hypocrite with I haven't done it until like a month ago I started,
right?
And that's now I'm like, oh, everybody should stretch.
Yeah, but that's good, but, you know, it's
working
good
for me.
Yeah. Well, like I say, I stretch a bit. I don't stretch enough. I know that.
Yeah,
But I try to listen to my body, but sometimes I forget to.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much for doing this, and we'll talk again in the future, I'm sure.
Thanks, Eric.
Evan Rad, shout-outs this week to Tyler from Volcom. I was able to swing by the new Volcom office in North Van and pick out a next year's kit from his samples. Also, I scored a pair of limited edition Gore-Tex Volcom gloves. The jacket I chose is my favorite ever, and you can check it out on my last couple of Instagram posts. Speaking of Instagram, I recently did a 10-day trip to Mexico with my amazing wife, and right before the trip, I forgot my phone in the car, so I didn't have my phone for 10 days straight. So fucking liberating. It's prompted me to rethink my social media life and consider the idea of getting an intern. So if one of you beautiful listeners loves to Instagram, hit me up. If you know somebody, tell them to hit me up. I'll probably have to get somebody local so I can actually meet with them in person here in Vancouver, but I'm open to all suggestions. So again, if you or someone you know wants to intern for the show, hit me up on the Effin' Rad Instagram. So thanks again, listeners, and make sure you come back next week for another episode of the Effin' Rad Snowboard Podcast presented by Vans and brought to you by SIA Productions.